This is your Uncle Don on CFUR with the 309th edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo. Prince George listeners are tuned in at 88.7 FM. I lived in fear that I would lack material for these shows with George Wanker Bush safely confined to his favorite state, Texas. I can still take the occasional shot at W, and there's ample ammunition right here at home in the ongoing outrages of the Harper regime. In case I wasn't thoroughly disgusted by the Harper regime already, I have additional support for that emotion. George Galloway, British Member of Parliament, was refused entry to Canada, where he was invited to give a speech. Supposedly, there's only one country that has ever refused admission to a sitting member of the British Parliament, and Canada holds that distinction. I suppose that Queen Elizabeth, our head of state, would not be amused, although she has too much class to comment publicly. Political pressure from the federal conservatives led to Galloway's exclusion as an alleged supporter of terrorism. His offense? He was instrumental in sending humanitarian aid to Gaza, though through their democratically elected government, Hamas. He's also been critical of Canada's participation in the Afghan occupation. For the longest time, the United States wore the crown as the world's premier paranoid nation. Now Canada's prime minister has snatched that honor from the Great Republic to the South. While we exclude Galloway, he has free entry to the U.S., where he's traveled and spoken often. Canada's rejection of this member of the Mother of Parliaments had nothing to do with security. It was a violation of Canadians' freedom to hear opinions critical of our government. Gutting the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation was not enough. They want to stifle anyone who dares question policies such as our war against Afghanistan and single-minded, unstinting support of any crime committed by Israel. The icing on the cake is the grand welcome granted to the notorious war criminal, demonstrably guilty of the most serious of offenses against the United Nations Charter, assorted treaties, and the laws of his own land, one responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of innocents, who is welcomed to Canada. When he came to Calgary, where else, for a paid speech to well-heeled worshippers, we provided him with police protection and allowed him to escape attempts at a citizen's arrest. And he made off with a couple $100,000 for his efforts. Any government that allows, nay, encourages the likes of George Bush to enter its land while prohibiting the entry of an honorable politician from its mother country has little of which to be proud. If you aren't disgusted, you're either a callous example of humanity or you haven't been paying attention. What do you suppose would be the official Canadian reaction if one of our members of Parliament were refused entry to the U.S., as Galloway was rejected by Harper's regime? If a typical Conservative MP, the most esteemed James Moore, Minister of Heritage, couldn't cross the border, we would all be outraged. Certainly no one could say that the esteemed Mr. Moore is a terrorist. Conceivably, he would be turned away on the grounds that he might claim refugee status, and Obama wouldn't want to risk having another pompous stooge in the country. There's already a surplus of that type left over from Bush's deposed crew. Or the United States might fear that he would use the opportunity to reproduce, a prospect horrifying to progressive Democrats. The United States will soon be reaching new heights in its program of total information awareness, a leftover from Bush's paranoid administration. Their spy agencies plan to launch a monstrous 137-meter helium-filled blimp to cruise the Earth at a height of 20 kilometers, keeping watch on terrestrial miscreants. It will be filled with helium and powered with hydrogen generated from solar cells. This unmanned craft is projected to stay aloft for 10 years, controlled from the ground and able to hover wherever the spy masters wish. Cost of this craft is projected to be $400 million, but we know what estimates are worth. The first stage in this program will see a one-third scale model of this behemoth launched by 2014. I have a few doubts around this project. The first is the underestimated cost, then the overestimated life. Will this machine work as planned? That depends on your view of the plans. It may be inefficient and ineffective in spying. It may not be launched on time, but it could be very efficient in generating profits for military contractors. The Guardian Weekly carried a review of the book The Spirit Level by Wilkinson and Pickett. The authors make the case that social dysfunction is closely correlated with income inequality. They looked at indicators like teenage pregnancy, mental illness, prison populations, murders, obesity, innumeracy, and illiteracy. They found that societies with higher inequality suffer more of those social ills. And these affect not just the poor. Even the rich in such nations have a higher incidence of mental illness and lower life expectancies. If the authors are correct that inequality is a cause of these problems rather than just a correlation, then the solution is obvious. All could be ameliorated by boosting incomes and security for the poor while reducing the extremes of income and wealth at the top. Here in Canada, we have an administration with a uniform answer to all problems: cut taxes. The data indicate that the opposite is a proper remedy. Raise taxes for top incomes, tax unearned capital gains at high rates, institute wealth and high inheritance tax, begin a vigorous campaign to ferret out wealth hidden from national taxes in various tax havens. The rich may scream, but who can justify a need for multimillion-dollar remuneration or wealth accumulated in the billions? The right of societies to lessen social ills trumps the rights of a small minority of the very rich. The growth of movements for greater economic equality should certainly make the wealthy tremble within their gated communities, in their limousines and penthouses, and on their private jets. Good, they can join the rest of us in being paranoid. Daniel Freeman, a senior fellow at Britain's Wellcome Trust, has studied the phenomenon of paranoia for 15 years. He wrote a book entitled Paranoia, the 21st Century Fear. He says that paranoia used to be attributed to the 1% of the population suffering from schizophrenia. He claims that some 25% of the British population exhibits some element of paranoia today. He postulates that paranoia exists as a spectrum of symptoms, not always in its distinct extreme form. Freeman figures the non-clinical paranoia has grown along with urbanization. It's correlated with depression and anxiety, vulnerability, and low self-esteem. All of these can result from globalization, migration, and yes, inequality. This implies that remedies I suggested for inequality could help reduce paranoia when accompanied by a retreat from rampant globalization making jobs insecure and driving people from their homes and roots. Freeman also noted that paranoia is more common among teens and those in their 20s, then increases again in old age. Certainly these are stages in life when one feels lack of control of one's destiny. Better schools with mentoring, better jobs for entrants, and secure pensions would all help combat this. Naturally, right-wing libertarian cases will object to intrusions on their rights to unlimited wealth and power. It's interesting how such opinions seem to dissolve when those individuals find themselves slipping in circumstances. Nothing like a turfed banker or insurance executive to suddenly embrace interference by governments when his enterprises blow up in his face. My thoughts return to Ridgewood, New Jersey, as I approached the ordeal of flying to Portugal in a couple of weeks. It was in that small town, when I was around 12, that my back was injured, causing me discomfort ever since. If I sit for more than an hour, I go from ache to pain to agony. Flying is the worst thing I could do. But I didn't want to burden you with details of my physical well-being. I'll talk instead about the growing quasi-sport of extreme fighting. There's a fierce dispute ongoing over whether these contests should be allowed in public and on television. I'm strongly on the negative side. Going back to Ridgewood, when I was a kid, a big thing, then as now, was so-called professional wrestling displays on television. I was playing with a neighbor kid one day when his big brother joined us to show a wrestling move called the airplane. I was to be his model opponent. He hoisted me over his head, spun me like a propeller, and threw me on the ground flat on my back. This boy grew up to make a lot of money. Too bad I couldn't sue him for my injury. His name was Jim Boughton, and his job was throwing baseballs for the New York Yankees. My opposition to extreme fighting is that kids will, like Jim Boughton, try on their peers what they see in the cages. We don't need another venue for teaching our children to be violent. Current movies and television contain plenty of role models for violent behavior without glorifying vicious loudmouths engaged in televised mayhem. On the surface, it appears mysterious that President Obama pays so much attention to the operations of the former Big Three auto companies while comparatively ignoring the finance industry. Wall Street's been given unprecedented amounts of money with little oversight. General Motors and Chrysler are being micromanaged while granted relatively small support. I can only surmise that Obama is willing to accept the wrath of many thousands of Democratic workers in the auto industry while throwing public funds at Republican financial institutions with good reason. He's determined that finance will carry on while the American auto industry is doomed. governments of the U.S. and Canada are lending gobs of money to those auto companies to keep them going while they downsize drastically. Will these loans ever be repaid, or will governments just absorb their losses? Even if those companies survive, they probably be unrecognizable, and the big three will never be heard of again. As I listened and read reports of auto industry bailouts and loans, there was one element conspicuously absent. Nowhere have I heard the word Mexico mentioned. As former giants close plants and shed workers in Canada and the U.S., might they be surreptitiously shifting production to maquiladora plants? We're still captives of the NAFTA, so this could easily happen. If not, why are we not hearing about Mexico? I have no answer. I'm amused by the ongoing collapse of Harper's rationalizations for continuing Canada's protracted Afghan war. The initial coalition attack on Afghanistan more than 7 years ago was in supposed retaliation for the al-Qaeda suicide assault on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. Remember? George Bush took advantage of these criminal actions to invoke a NATO clause making an attack on one member an attack on all. His claim was that al-Qaeda was an arm of the so-called Taliban government of Afghanistan. Ironically, the Taliban was the residue of the Mujahideen, an outfit once armed and paid for by the United States to drive Russians out of Afghanistan. The snake had turned and bitten the snake charmer, if you accept that suicide attacks were actually sanctioned and supported by the Taliban, a charge never proven. This attack on Afghanistan was, of course, a perversion of the intent of NATO. 6 decades ago, that organization was formed as a common front against a perceived Soviet threat to invade Western Europe. The Soviet Union is dissolved, as is NATO's eastern nemesis, the Warsaw Pact. From a defensive alliance, NATO has morphed into a sort of American auxiliary military arm. The coalition of the willing, so celebrated by the unlamented lesser Bush, was a collection of reluctant nations bribed by the U.S. or sucking up to the Bush regime in search of favors. The government of Afghanistan, however repugnant it might have been to Western values, has been replaced by a puppet administration with little control or actual power, but which is proving to be about as distasteful as its predecessor. So what keeps us sacrificing soldiers and resources in this protracted mess? In a candid moment, Harper himself admitted that the war is unwinnable. We were engaged in a crusade. Oops, scratch that term, a mission to rid the world of Osama bin Laden and his crew. 8 years later and bin Laden continues to make amateur videos, so forget that. Well, we got rid of the Taliban, right? Now our soldiers can travel anywhere they like at any time without fear. Scratch that. At least we're granting the Afghan people the blessings of democracy free of warlords and feudalism. Scratch that also. In these 7 years, we've made great strides in wiping out corruption among police and civil officials. Forget that. The final coup was freeing women and girls to resume their place as equals in a society free of medieval law and restrictions. Oops. Say, wait a minute, what the hell are we doing in Afghanistan again? They've stuck it to Abdulrazak again. In spite of assurances that this Canadian citizen would be allowed to return from Sudan, where he is stranded, Harper's minion, Foreign Minister Lawrence Cannon, has again refused this poor bugger a temporary travel document necessary for readmission to Canada. Recall that this man has the absolute right under our Charter of Rights and Freedoms and under international law to return to his country of citizenship. First, they said he needed merely to get an airline to agree to bring him home. When he did that, Cannon said he needed a prepaid ticket, which, with the help of numerous Canadians, myself included, he bought. Now Cannon says Abdulrazak must extricate himself from the UN no-fly list, an impossibility considering the U.S. vetoes any such removal. I suppose it is up to this poor devil to join the stream of illegal immigrants smuggled to North America. He could then turn up on Canadian shores and reclaim his citizenship, for what that's worth. Today it's Abdulrazak, tomorrow it could be any one of us trying to return from a visit overseas. If the precedent of his exclusion is allowed to stand, it could be applied to anyone the government of the day dislikes. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. If I were Auditor General Sheila Fraser, I'd think seriously before going overseas, as she's incurred the wrath of the Harper regime. She could be surreptitiously added to that no-fly list. She dared to blame the backlog of cases before the Immigration and Refugee Board on Harper's failure to fill vacancies on the board. Cabinet has delayed, for whatever reason, to make necessary appointments. Surely this was not due to a lack of Tory sycophants needing to be shielded from the realities of Canada's economic failures. While Harper cuts services like the CBC in the name of saving precious taxpayer dollars, refugee claimants draw on social services while awaiting adjudication. Some of these people will be deported eventually, so money spent on them while in limbo is totally wasted. And this board is not the only one suffering Harper's procrastination. Sheila says it shows a lack of respect to senior officials when positions are left vacant. But then, why should bureaucrats remain exempt from the profound disrespect that Harper shows for the rest of Canadians? Stephen Harper announced that Canada will be shifting our meager foreign aid from Africa toward Latin America and the Caribbean. First of all, why have 8 needy African countries been removed from the list of priority recipients to be replaced by comparatively wealthy countries like Colombia, Peru, and Caribbean island nations? There's obviously been a policy shift from sending Canadian aid to where it is most needed and to middle-income nations where it can bring us economic advantage. We have free trade agreements in place or under negotiation with most of these new beneficiaries. Would it be fair to speculate that Ottawa will be using taxpayers' money to bribe these nations to give commercial advantage to Canadian companies? And does this not pervert the concept of foreign aid from providing a hand up to those most in need? And my second question is this: where were the parliamentary and public debates over redirection of our aid money? This isn't my idea of open and accountable government. It's just more of the dictatorial regime using public assets to benefit its friends' commercial interests. Marcus G. Denison of the Globe and Mail's editorial pages has come up with another intemperate attack on China. It seems that this unfortunate nation can do nothing that pleases Mr. G. This time it's China's, quote, craving for resources to fuel its ever-expanding economy has led it to support 2 of the world's nastiest regimes, Zimbabwe and Sudan. They get Chinese weapons in return, close quote. China even had the audacity to make a deal with America's nemesis, Iran, to buy its natural gas. Before jumping on board with Marcus on this one, perhaps we should, as the Bible enjoins us, seek out the beam in our own eye before criticizing the mote in China's. Did we not trade with South Africa during the worst of its days of oppressing its black majority? We seemed happy to accept their diamonds, gold, and minerals without questioning the conditions under which they were mined. Do we not now trade with, support, and glorify Israel while it holds an entire nation of Palestine as virtual prisoners in Gaza? Were we not glad to trade with and allow our corporations to invest in Chile, even as Pinochet's murderers terrorized the entire population? We hear little criticism of Saudi Arabia as long as we can buy their oil. This entire nation is a captive of a single extended family, denying the most basic rights to its female inhabitants. Did we not support free trade with a certain nation which kidnapped people and sent them off to be tortured in an enclave of Cuba? I could go on as to the hypocrisy of Marcus G. in his criticisms of China, but I'll let it rest. I'll be pleased when he comes around to advocating our pulling troops out of a country that institutes legalized rape as our soldiers die to support its corrupt regime. Speaking of Afghanistan, prisoners there won the right to contest their detention in U.S. courts. And naturally, this is not an unalloyed right. It applies only to non-Afghans captured outside the country. Before setting off the fireworks and bringing on the cake, let's ask a question. By what natural right has the United States of America to capture citizens of any nation, transport them to an air base in occupied Afghanistan, and keep them under lock and key? When I go to Portugal later this month, will the U.S. feel it has the right to snatch me off the street in Lisbon and transport me to a god-awful dungeon where I may graciously be granted the right to plead for my release in an American court? Something's out of kilter there, and it's time for the rest of the world to take a serious look at this mess. The second section of our Charter of Rights and Freedoms contains the following guarantee. Everyone has the following fundamental freedoms: freedom of peaceable assembly and freedom of association. Now, I'd reckon this means that interested persons can, without impediment, gather together and form a group to look after their mutual interests. People do this every day. We may form a bridge club, a political party, or a university affinity group. No big deal. Would this not apply to the right to form an association of co-workers to look after their joint interest? That is the definition of a union. In U.S. labor history, we learned of a group of Philadelphia cordwainers, or shoemakers, who once formed a union to control their working conditions and wages. At that time, the law looked at this as a conspiracy and restraint of trade, and cordwainers were prosecuted. These workers and others battled, often dying, in the long struggle to legalize unions. It was not until the Wagner Act in 1935 that the right to organize was enshrined in American law. I assumed that this applied in Canada also, but I guess I was wrong. Our Supreme Court just ruled that Ontario agricultural workers will have to wait another year before being granted the privilege of forming a union. The province argued against this granting this privilege. 30,000 Ontario agriculture workers may form unions in 2010. So what happens if these workers organize today, demanding better wages and working conditions? Will they be declared illegal associations, warranting armed force to disband them? Cesar Chavez formed a union of grape workers in California 40 years ago, and after long boycotts and bloody battles, won recognition. I can think of no reason why workers in Canada need the permission of a province, the federal government, or anyone else to build a union to promote their mutual interests. Harold Moffat, one-time mayor of Prince George, died last week. He was a member of the old established Moffat family, owners of the Northern Hardware Store, an institution in our town. Harold was noted for his reference to the signature stink in Prince George as the smell of money. He stood against the building of our new library, as libraries don't make a profit and are therefore useless. Harold was instrumental in bringing three pulp mills to town in the 60s. In the face of opposition from environmentalists, he insisted that they be constructed within city limits so we could capture taxes from them. History has proven that having these mills within the bowl has come at a cost. Air pollution in Prince George, a good part of it coming directly from these mills. Dr. Laurie Cook, representing the Prince George Medical Society, claims that air quality here costs us 21 premature deaths a year. Can we balance a quantity of deaths against a quantity of money? Harold did. We have an organization here called the Prince George Air Improvement Roundtable, dedicated, as you may surmise, to ameliorating our characteristic lousy atmosphere. It's composed of assorted members of government, the university, the People's Action Committee for Healthy Air, and industry stakeholders. This valiant organization, bent on cutting that annual toll of 21 premature deaths, has determined in their infinite wisdom to hold their next and perhaps subsequent monthly meetings in camera. The chairwoman of this committee has concerns about the accuracy of reporting coming out of the meetings. "We need to control the message," she said. "This decision stinks like the air they're discussing. Is this just a local manifestation of Harper's and Campbell's perversion of open and accountable government? Has the need to control the message filtered down all the way to the municipal level now? As for me, I've had a belly full of controlled messages and propaganda. I see no reason why these meetings, like the rest of government, should not be as open as possible to public view and participation. Interested individuals should be at meetings on air quality. The press should be there. If decisions taken are detrimental to public welfare, perhaps prompted by these industry stakeholders, protesters should be there. We're in the midst of a painful economic collapse that was largely precipitated by secret financial deals done out of the public view. If we're to prevent other disasters, we need a public spotlight shown on surreptitious deals and decisions that affect us. We can start right here with these air quality meetings." During World War II, American forces closed in on Japan, hopping from South Pacific Island to island in their advance. On a number of these islands, as soon as the Japanese were expelled, air bases were rapidly constructed from which further islands were attacked. Natives of these islands, many of whom had had no contact with the outside world, watched in wonder as aircraft arrived on these airstrips, unloading the wondrous products of civilization. When the soldiers moved on, many of these lanes were kept clear and others built by natives who believed, if you build it, they will come. This was the root of cargo cults. They believed that airports attract the cornucopia of civilization. I thought that cargo cults were dead. Perhaps they are in the South Pacific, but not in central British Columbia. Prince George's Airport Authority had faith that an extended airstrip here would attract jumbo jets for refueling on their trips between the U.S. and Asia. They spent multi-millions of public money on concrete and steel to lay this pavement. So far, no jumbo jets. Perhaps we should be beating drums or sacrificing virgins to induce the air gods to honor our little town with their gifts. Chrysler was recently compelled to close two Canadian assembly plants for lack of parts. These could be the opening shots of a collapse of the auto industry. Over the years, the former giants have farmed out parts production to small companies, gradually becoming more and more mere assemblers of bits and pieces and produced by others. With cutbacks in production at Chrysler, GM, and Ford, some of these parts makers are being pushed to the brink of bankruptcy themselves. A company with high capital costs and big debts may be able to make good money when flat out, but even a minor cutback can drive them into the red. Couple this with the fear that bankruptcy of an auto company could mean the supplier would receive only a percentage of what the giant owes, and there's a reluctance to continue extending credit to the company. A temporary halt in production due to lack of parts ripples back down the supply lines, causing other small suppliers to cut production. In auto manufacture, as with many other industries, the business model was based on continuing operation at full capacity. Capital costs, debt servicing, dividends, and good salaries could be sustained at that level, but not at lower one. The auto industry as a whole has been constructed as a house of cards, vulnerable to the winds of change. Governments are well aware that the entire structure could collapse, taking a good part of the North American economy with it. Only now is this beginning to dawn on the public. All the massive support offered may be lost in a futile effort to restore a past that could join the buggy whip industry as history. Governments everywhere are issuing dire warnings of the danger of nationalistic protectionism. Stimulus of individual economies must not be circumscribed with rules that limit their effects within borders. When France encouraged its auto industry to produce at home while shuttering a plant in Eastern Europe, they faced stern rebukes. How dare they? President Obama mounts his high horse at the G20 meeting to tell the world how evil protectionism is. Meanwhile, American stimulus spending is subject to conditions by Congress, allowing any but the U.S. steel to be used in funded projects. Both Canada and the U.S. are throwing gobs of money at our car companies to entice them to continue productions here. Billions or trillions are lavished on our banks and financial industry to keep them alive in the face of foreign competition. Face it, we're into a serious round of national protectionism. Politicians are trying to disguise it as best they can, but it's here, there, and everywhere. Yes, it is damage to the world economies, but elected officials are responsible to their constituents, not the rest of the planet. It was American protectionism that protracted the Great Depression of the 30s. It's universal protectionism which may extend today's recession into another depression. And there's bugger all we can do about it. This concludes Uncle Don's 309th Weekly Happy Hour on CFUR. This has been the Porcupine Petting Zoo, coming at you from 88.7 FM in Prince George.